Lecture 3, The Prehistory of English, the Indo-European Context.
Hello, and welcome back to the history of the English language. This is our third lecture, and we're going to begin this lecture by reviewing some of the key methods and problems that I developed in the last one, and then we're going to look closely at Indo-European. Now, you'll remember from the last lecture, I came up with four myths for the study of language. Myths, as I call them, that have textured or inflected our general understanding of how language changes and develops. But also, I came up with a series of particular methodological lines of inquiry and some foci for our study. Articulatory phonetics, sociolinguistics, and comparative philology. Those are the primary methods that we will use in the study of the history of the language. The four objects of our study, pronunciation, grammar or morphology, meaning or semantics or semantic change, and attitudes towards language change and variation. Now, in this lecture, I want to introduce you to the study of Indo-European, a historical problem in what has come to be called comparative philology, but also an important moment in what I am calling the prehistory of English. Now, let me begin by defining some terms. Indo-European is a term used to describe several things. First, it's the term used to describe a collection of languages spoken in Europe, present-day Iran, and northern India. These languages are believed to be related, that is, they are believed to have descended from a common language or group of dialects spoken by a collection of people that we refer to as the Indo-Europeans, who probably lived in the 3rd or 4th millennium BC in southeastern Europe, probably in the area around the Black Sea. The Indo-European languages that survive today are the languages of Iran, particular modern-day Farsi, Greek, the Romance languages descending from Latin, Italian, French, Spanish, Romanian, Armenian, the Germanic languages, which include modern-day German and English, the language of Albania, the Slavic languages, Russian, Serbo-Croatian, Polish, and so on, the Celtic languages, Welsh, Erse, and the Baltic languages, Lithuanian and Latvian. There are also two branches of Indo-European which have languages that do not survive. And it's interesting to mention them now because their discovery played an important role in the 19th and 20th centuries in developing the idea of the Indo-European languages. One of these languages was the language of the Hittites, an ancient people who lived in Asia Minor in the 2nd century BC, and who, I'm sorry, in the 2nd millennium BC, and who are mentioned prominently in the Bible, and another group of languages called Tocharian, which is a group of languages which are preserved in written documents which are found in western Tibet. Now, this clutch of languages shares many things in common, certain sounds, certain words, and certain forms. And as I will be talking about today, in this lecture today, these languages were part of a series of discoveries and reconstructions in the late 18th and 19th centuries that gave European scholars a sense of where their own living languages had come from. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Indo-Europeans. Who were they? Where did they come from? How do we know who they were? It's generally believed, and I'm going to present this as a consensus of scholarly opinion. I think it's generally believed that the Indo-Europeans were an agricultural population, that they lived in southeastern Europe around the 4th or 3rd millennium BC. Recent archaeological discoveries have suggested that this was a people who buried their dead, probably in mounds. This is as opposed to cremating their dead. And that they moved into Central Europe about the 3rd millennium BC. And that there were a series of migrations into Asia Minor, into the Indo-Iranian areas, and then later into the Mediterranean and Northern Europe. How do we know anything about a group of people that lived 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, that left no written records, and very few and highly ambiguous archaeological remains? The evidence we have is the evidence from the languages. If you survey the living and the dead Indo-European languages, you'll begin to notice a set of shared words or concepts. Let me read some of them to you. Virtually all the Indo-European languages have a word for snow. In German, snow. Old English, snow. German, Schnee. Old Norse, Schnarr. Gothic, Schnaus. Latin, Nivis. Greek, Nipta. Russian, Schneeg. Lithuanian, Sniegas. Irish, Nektar. Sanskrit, Snee. Many of them had a word for the beech tree. Beech. German, Buche. Old Norse, Bok. This is related to our word book, too. It corresponds to the initial F sound in Greek and Latin. So the Latin word for beech is phagos. The Greek word phagos is a tree more like an oak than a beech. All of them had a word for corn. Almost all of them had a word for wolf. Many of them had a word for bear. And almost all of them had a word for mead, an alcoholic beverage made from fermented honey. Scholars in the 19th century surveyed these words, and they came to certain conclusions which more modern scholars believe are supported by archaeological evidence. In other words, by looking at these shared vocabulary terms, it's possible to posit that the Indo-Europeans were a people who lived where it snowed. It's possible to posit that the Indo-Europeans were a people who lived where certain trees grew. It's possible to posit that the Indo-Europeans were a people who lived where certain animals, like wolves and bears, could be found. These kinds of meteorological and topographical phenomena suggest that our languages preserve a core vocabulary whose value lies in reconstructing archaeologically the place of these Indo-Europeans. But let's stop right there. What happens when you look at Indo-European words for heart, lung, head, foot, night, star, sun, moon? Well, the first thing you discover is that all the Indo-European languages have a shared word for them. I'll just read them out. Just listen. Heart, herz, charta, harta, cardis, cardia, serta, shirtis, krid, krid, heart. Lung, lungen, lungen, lunge, lech, lebes, elachas, legor, lingus, lagul, lachas. Habit, haupt, head, havas, kaput. Foot, fuß, foter, foter, pedis, podos. Nicht, nacht, 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 nachtis, nuchtos, nacht, nichtis, nacht. Stera. Stern, star, stjarna, sterno, stella, aster. Sunne, son, sol, saul, sol, helios, sonnister, sola. Mona, mon, mane, mena, mensis. It's our word month from the moon, mensis. Could we say that, well, all of the Indo-Europeans had hearts. They had lungs. They had heads. They had feet. They lived in places where you had night and you could see stars. There's a certain sense in which it becomes almost laughable to do this kind of comparison. What we need to understand from this information are really two things. One is, what is meaningful information about place, about locale, about culture, and about society? But also, what is meaningful information about what kinds of words stay in language? A truism, it seems to me, of the history of language is that the core vocabulary for body parts, for obvious meteorological or cosmic phenomena, and for certain key animals or plants, stay in the language because it is a core vocabulary. It's not important to say, it seems to me, that because Indo-Europeans all had words for hearts and lungs, we imagine that they had hearts and lungs, imagining, of course, that there could be a people that didn't. Rather, what's important is to say that words for hearts and lungs and heads are so important that they stay almost unchanged in language, that they are a core vocabulary in some fundamental sense. When we look, therefore, at Indo-European, when we look at our methods for historical philology, and when we look at the relationship between Indo-European languages and their study and the history of English, we're looking, therefore, at a series of words and approaches that can help us understand just how to study language historically. Now, why should we spend time on this material? I think there are a couple of important reasons. In tracing the origin of words back through time, we are, I believe, reconstructing something of a social or an intellectual structure. And we can also see how words of seemingly different sound and sense in modern languages go back to shared origins. As I mentioned in my last lecture, I am just captivated by Indo-European. And I'm fascinated by the ways in which we can take seemingly disparate languages and recover earlier sounds, earlier forms, and earlier meanings. There is a magic to the philology of Indo-European. I think there's a magic to the historical study of language in general. And part of my indulgence in this material is my sharing with you my fascination with this magic. But the other thing that fascinates me are the magicians. Who made these discoveries? Who came to understand how the languages were related? What went on in the minds of the scholar? The idea of Indo-European, the idea of a shared origin for European languages, is an idea that originates at the end of the 18th century. When scholars, in particular, scholars of European ancestry posted to colonial positions, come in contact with non-European languages that seem unusually familiar in certain kinds of ways. Now, up until this time, the historical study of language was carried on, for the most part, not by linguists of contemporary languages, but by scholars of dead languages, students of the Bible in particular. You studied Greek, Hebrew, Latin, Syriac. You studied the old languages to get at the root meaning of the Bible. And the historical study of word origins was infused both with a controlling spiritualism of biblical study, but also with a kind of controlling mythology, which was a leftover, as it were, of earlier medieval notions of language. I use a word like etymology to mean the origin or root of a word. But in the 17th and early 18th centuries, a scholar would use a word like etymology very often the way in which perhaps a medieval scholar might use a word like etymology. In other words, not to trace back the historical root of a word, but to find something of its spiritual or physical meaning. The best example I can think of is an ancient one, one that survives well into the Renaissance. Ignis and lignis. The word for wood lignum, lignus, inheres in the word for fire. Ignis, ignis, lignus. This is an etymology. It's not a modern etymology, and you won't find it in a dictionary, but it's what passed for etymological work. The idea that, why does wood burn? Well, because the word for wood has the word for fire somehow in it. It's kind of like a cryptogram. What happens at the close of the 18th century is a group of individuals start studying language in a new way. And one of the most important figures to study language in a new way was Sir William Jones. He was a diplomat posted to India, and he was an amateur and very soon important semi-professional linguist. Jones began to notice certain shared features in the vocabulary of the ancient classical language of India, Sanskrit. They were shared with Latin and Greek and other modern European languages. For example, he noticed that the Sanskrit and modern Indian word Raj, which means a kingdom or an empire, looked very, very similar to words like the Latin Rex, king, or the German word Reich, meaning an empire, or the Celtic suffix Rix, R-I-X, which was found at the end of certain names in Celtic documents. For example, like Vercingetorix, the Rix ending indicated a position of political or military control, a king or a ruler. Etymologically, Asterix, the character from the cartoon, has a perfect Celtic name, except Asterix means king of the stars. And of course, our modern word, rich. So Jones began to notice certain shared words, of which this is the most obvious. He noticed also that forms of the verb to be were very, very similar in these ancient and modern languages. And Jones posited that these various languages must have descended from an original tongue. In 1799, he gave an address to the Asiatic Society, which was meeting in Calcutta. And I want to read to you a passage from that address in which he outlines some of his researches and some of his conclusions. And he says, "It's much to be lamented that neither the Greeks who attended Alexander into India, nor those who were long connected with it under the Bactrian princes, have left us any means of knowing with accuracy what vernacular languages they found on their arrival in this empire. The Sanskrit language," Jones goes on, "whatever be its antiquity, is of wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists. There is a similar reason, though not quite so forcible, for supposing that both the Gothic, by which he means the German language, and the Celtic, though blended with a very different idiom, had the same origin with the Sanskrit. And the Old Persian," Jones continues, "might be added to the same family if this were the place for discussing any question concerning the antiquities of Persia." Now, what does this tell us? This tells us several things. This is a quotation that tells us something about how Jones made certain associations, but it's also a text that takes us back to the myths of language. Jones's idea here is that if the Indo-European languages descended from a shared or common original, then that original must somehow be better, more perfect than the later languages. He implies a notion of linguistic decay and corruption. When he uses phrases like wonderful structure, he notices that Sanskrit is a grammatically complicated language. When he says it's more perfect than the Greek, how can something be more perfect? I thought something was perfect, or it wasn't perfect. How can it be more copious than the Latin? Latin had thousands and thousands of words borrowed from many, many languages and more exquisitely refined than either. When Jones uses words or phrases like these, he's not describing language, he's describing social attitudes. He's describing a love of antiquity. He's describing a notion of linguistic change as a notion of decay, or of corruption, or of falling away. It's perfectly in keeping with a late 18th century fascination with the antique, with the ruined, with the fragmentary. Jones's discovery, in quotation marks, of Sanskrit, or his imagination of a shared Indo-European language, is as much a product of its time as, let's say, the recovery of the ruins of Pompeii, or the fascination with the ruined landscapes of a classical world. In the 19th century, scholars developed Jones's ideas, and in Germany in particular, they began to codify relationships among languages into what came to be known as sound laws. They also proposed lines of descent among the different languages. And here, one of the most important metaphors or images for language change and development takes place. And this is the idea of the language tree, which in 19th century German philological terms would have been the Stammbäume, the stem trees, the Baum, the tree of language. At its roots, indeed our very word, roots of language, has this arboreal metaphor behind it. At its roots are the ancient languages, and then the great trunks, and then the branching out. Our notion, our idea of language branching out is a 19th century notion that gives us an organicism to language change. That's the heart of the metaphor. Or think of language families, the idea that language has a paternity or a maternity, that language gives birth to children, that there are families or cousins or relationships that are in some sense genetic among languages. These are the images and the idioms that 19th century philologists developed. And in many ways, they stay with us. But the important thing that is developed, and the thing I want to stress here, is the idea that the discovery of Indo-European, the positing of sound law relationships, the historical study of languages, these become, as it were, what I will call the constitutive practice of linguistics. In other words, to be a linguist in the 19th century was to be a comparative philologist of Indo-European. This is a very important development, and it's something I really want to stress as part of our general narrative of the history of studying languages. Is linguistics, is the study of language, the study of language as it exists at the moment? Or should it be the study of the historical development of language? Are we occupied with philosophical concerns, or are we occupied with philological concerns? What the 19th century does, what the discovery, the development, or if you will, even the invention of Indo-European does, is it makes the historical study of language the business of linguistics, generally speaking. We're going to see towards the end of this course how important it is for 20th century linguists to challenge that. 19th century linguists develop it. In particular, it's a group of linguists in the later 19th century, a group who came to be known as neo-grammarians or new grammarians or young grammarians, who develop these sound laws into rules. Now, in my subsequent lecture, I'm going to be looking at a couple of these sound laws, and in particular, I'm going to look at something called Grimm's Law, which is a set of sound relationships among consonants in the Indo-European languages. Grimm's Law is a basic set of relationships that scholars have used to reconstruct earlier meanings and earlier forms of the language. But what Grimm's Law is also in many ways about is the idea that language can behave according to certain laws or rules. I was in my university bookstore just 2 weeks ago, and I was looking at some books, and there was a book called The Laws of Indo-European. And I thought, well, here's a fascinating study on the reconstruction of the Indo-European legal vocabulary. And maybe I'll learn something about the origins of justice or about the meeting out of pleasure and pain 3,000 years ago. And I opened it up, and it was a series of sound laws, each one of which was named after the 19th century philologist who discovered it. This idea that language works according to law or rule is a central one. But also, I don't want to dismiss the empirical here. I don't want to suggest that by critiquing the attitudes or the idioms of early philologists, that we have to dismiss the evidence that they arrived at. A certain amount of that evidence is immensely valuable. I've suggested a little bit about how some of that evidence can be used to locate the Indo-Europeans in certain ways. You can also locate the Indo-Europeans as they moved. Let me give you some examples of that, and let's think of some ways of bridging from this lecture to the next lecture, where we will look in particular at the tone of Indo-European philology. As the Indo-Europeans moved out from their home area, they encountered speakers of other non-Indo-European languages. Believe it or not, some non-Indo-European words or sounds showed up in the borrowed words of these new Indo-Europeans. Any word that ends in the sound inth, which we would write I-N-T-H, is not an Indo-European word. What does that mean? That means that words like plinth, labyrinth, the town of Corinth, the flower hyacinth, these are words borrowed from the pre-Indo-European peoples inhabiting certain areas that were absorbed by, perhaps conquered by, perhaps engaged with by the Indo-Europeans. It's interesting that many of them are Greek. It's interesting that many of them are mythological, suggesting perhaps that the myth of the labyrinth is itself more ancient than the Greeks, or that the story of the hyacinth has similar antiquity. Let's take another good example. The Indo-Europeans had many words in common, but what's interesting to see are the words they didn't have in common. The Indo-Europeans do not share a word for the sea. The Germanic languages all have related words for the sea. See, say, sigh, all words that sound like that in the Germanic languages, Scandinavian, English, modern continental German. It's as if the group of peoples who broke off had to discover the sea on their own. The Greek word for sea is thalassa. A thalassocracy is a word that means a political entity run by the navy. They discover the sea on their own. The word thalassa is unrelated to the other words. But all the Indo-European languages have words that begin with the nav sound, meaning a boat or a ship, or a word beginning with era or roa, meaning to row. So there must have been a body of water in the home of the Indo-Europeans. But something like the sea must have been discovered by each group as they broke off. I think to some degree this constitutes evidence for migration and movement. And it constitutes evidence for the great antiquity of certain words in our language. Now, in this lecture, I've tried to give you just a taste of some aspects of Indo-European. And in my next two lectures, I'm going to try and go into some detail about historical reconstruction. How can we take words from modern languages and use them to reconstruct the words and the belief systems of the Indo-European peoples as a whole? But furthermore, I want to suggest in closing this lecture that we look ahead to the next couple of lectures to think not just of topography, landscape, things, but also to the imagination. The Indo-Europeans had clearly a rich literary and poetic tradition, and many of our words for poetry and the imagination have their origin in the older Indo-European languages. And so part of what I'm going to be looking at are not just places of life, but what we might call landscapes of the mind's interior. And so for the next lecture, we will be looking at these patterns of reconstruction of both the literal and the imaginative, the real and the metaphorical, the lived and the dreamt. Thank you.